What up, meepsters? This is Ryan Rainbro, and if you're hearing this, that means you're about to listen to one of the 99 free episodes of the Meep Meep Podcast, available wherever you cast pods. But keep in mind that there are new and unreleased episodes of the show on patreon.com/meepmeeppod. So you'll want to sign up there to hear future episodes and also other side projects like Choo Choo, the show about soundtracks, and contribute suggestions for future episodes as well. Will I listen to your suggestion? There's only one way to find out. patreon.com/meepmeeppod. Bye! Welcome to Meep Meep, the Roadrunner podcast, where we go through the albums of Roadrunner Records with the artists who made them and the musicians they influenced. Let's roll! What up, meepsters? It's Ryan Rainbro, and I'm back again to help you and I explore the catalog of Roadrunner Records on the only podcast about the albums of Roadrunner Records currently. Ever in the past? I've been to the future to double check. Nothing there. Might only be the only podcast in general. X-Men? I think it's called X-Men, and it peaked at Days of Future Past. Okay. Joe Rogan? I'm pretty sure he was the second string host of The Man Show, so I'm pretty sure he doesn't have a podcast. And if he does, I bet it doesn't sound as echoey as I do right now. I'm in a new Meep Meep HQ. That's a headquarters. And haven't quite filled out the room yet with all my stuff. So it's a little echoey. So, you know, bear with me. Or, congratulations, you get to hear my voice harmonizing with itself. Today, we're in 1997, a very important year. And we're talking about Junkie XL, which I assume stands for Junkie Extra Large. And you know what happens when you assume? You're always right. And Junkie XL's debut album on Roadrunner Records entitled Saturday Teenage Kick. Now, 1997, again, this is a big year for me, okay? My CD collection's really small because I've just gotten the Kenwood CD player. All right, I'm just starting to build up that. My cassette collection, it's minimal, all right? Most of it is the Goofy movie soundtrack. But in 97, a bunch of pivotal albums come out. Cold Chamber's self-titled, which we've talked about. Incubus, Science. Deftones, Around the Fur. And also Head PE's self-titled album. Now, Head P.E. released a single from that album called Serpent Boy that still rocks. And on that single, it had a big old sticker that said Remix by Junkie XL. And I started seeing those kind of stickers all the time. It was on Remanufacture by Fear Factory. It was on other remixes by bands that I liked. So when I went to Manifest Discs and Tapes and saw that Junkie XL had an album, I was like, okay, well, I think I'm willing to invest and see what this sounds like, and I was not disappointed. Now, the Junkie XL album is actually more of a band. Junkie XL himself is Tom Holkenborg, who you may know from his number one hit in a couple dozen countries in 2002 with the remix of Elvis's A Little Less Conversation, and also more recently he scores huge Hollywood movies like The Snyder Cut for the Justice League. So he's definitely made an incredible career for himself since Saturday Teenage Kick, but even at this time, he's a pretty big deal, especially in kind of the rock, big beat, techno world that's really blowing up around this time. Prior to working on the Saturday Teenage Kick album with the Silver Surfering Rude Boy Remington, Patrick Tillen, who we'll be talking to later, who provides the vocals for the Junkie XL album from the legendary Urban Dance Squad, he's in other kind of industrial bands like Weekend at Waikiki and Nerve. And Nerve is kind of on Roadrunner's radar with A&R rep Lucas Van Slegdenhorst and Alain Verhava. So we're going to talk to Lucas about signing the band and signing Tom, really, forming the band with him. And, you know, kind of the strategy that went into really making this record and what an important landmark it is for Tom Holkenborg, Junkie XL himself, and Lucas. This record comes out in 97. When do you start working with Roadrunner Records? Is it shortly before, or is it because of this album?
Before Roadrunner Records, I started in the music business as a radio plugger for BMG. And I got asked to work for Roadrunner as a product manager for a joint venture that they had with a label, German label called Edel Records. And maybe you know this German, house band called Scooter. And that was one of their most important acts. And I was a big fan of Roadrunner at the time.
Scooter was on the Mortal Kombat soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I know who Scooter is.
Yeah, it was actually Edel Records that released it, but the joint venture that we had was for Edel, it's like Edel Benelux with Roadrunner. And so when I got asked to become product manager for that joint venture, I was like, okay, it's Edel, but it gives me the opportunity to work for Roadrunner. And that was like a dream coming true because I was a metal kind of fan as well. So that's how I rolled into Roadrunner as an employee. Eventually, because I think you want to know how I eventually became an A&R manager.
Right.
I think like when I was the product manager, it was like working for half a year. And then I already expressed that I wanted to do some more on the side because I had some time left in the job. And so I worked with Alain Verhaven, who was leading the Dutch office of Roadrunner and also marketing manager. And he said, well, just look around. If you see something, you can do some A&R stuff maybe. With Tom Hawkermore, Junkie XL, Alain was already working with him because he made some dance remixes for like Doggy Dog and Fear Factory and everything. And that was really, going well. And I found out, I knew Tom through that situation with the remixes that he already made. And at a certain moment, I got a demo tape from a guy called Rod Chong, which was a friend of Tom. It was really cool. It was like a prodigy style music, big beat stuff. And I was also a little bit into dances at that time, electronic stuff, but more the alternative electronic stuff. So Gamble Brothers, Prodigy, blah, 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 Underworld. And the demo that I got, which was made by Rod Chong, Rod Chong gave it to me. It was really great. So I was like, whoa, this is something we should release. We should sign this on Roadrunner. And then Tom Hawkenborg found out about it and said, well, oh, wait a second. I made the production. So it was like, it's not Rod. He said Rod did the creative stuff, but I did everything in the music. I played everything, I produced everything. So then I talked to Alain and I think he was already doing the remix under the Junkie XL name, but just to have a name for the remixes that he made. When we signed Junkie XL, actually before that, we tried to sign Nerf, which was his band, his first band, Tom Hawkenborg, together with Phil Mills. And so I was going to a Nerf show to check it out, talk with Tom. So that's how I already knew Tom. And of course, because of the remixes. So it wasn't like only that demo tape of Rod Chong. It was also that we were already talking to Tom about Nerve. But with the demo tape from Rod Chong, with this electronic rock kind of crossover project, that led to the fact that we were more interested maybe in Junkie XL album. And that was also the moment when he decided to stop with Nerve and focus on Junkie XL. So that's how the actual signing came in. So, and Alain and I were like, why don't we then, sign Tom as Junkie XL and then let him make an album, because this is great stuff. And that's how basically my A&R career started.
Like you mentioned, Junkie XL does a lot of the remixes on Fear Factory's remanufacture album, I should say, that comes out the same year. So he wasn't signed to the label yet when he's doing that, but that kind of made you aware of his work because he was already doing stuff with you guys?
Yeah, we were already working with him, but I really think that the fact that we got that demo from Rod Chong with this other project, that made open our eyes or ears. And it was that was the moment where we were, oh, wait a second, if this is also Tom. Because those are original new songs. The demo had like four tracks. And it was really awesome. Cassette tape, great. and so that's how we kind of knew, okay, we can maybe try to, release an album out of Junkie XL with original songs. So.
And did those songs on that demo end up being on Saturday Teenage Kick?
No. Tom made all new, totally new stuff. Yeah. All new songs. Yeah.
Did you have any apprehension? I mean, you're telling me you're a metal guy. You're excited to work for Roadrunner. Of course, historically a metal label, Junkie XL, even adding the guitars and things like that, certainly not a metal act. So did you have any apprehension with that?
Well, obviously I like metal a lot, but I was also liking, if you have electronic music, you have two sides. You have the very commercial, cheesy dance music, had the top 40 stuff, and you have the alternative stuff, which is on big festivals, or let's say at that time was on the alternative festivals, and it was really cool electronic stuff. And it had a certain heaviness. The Chemical Brothers had this rough kind of heavy kind of dance element to it. It had hip-hop influences. And so at that time, it was more the big beat that was really popular instead of techno or... So for me, it was kind of normal, also because I was used as a plugger, radio plugger, to plug a variation of records on BMG from rock to dance and hip hop and everything. It wasn't a problem for me to look at this as a Roadrunner act, although Tom and Alain and I were like, okay, we should form a band because it needs to perform live. Roadrunner is a label that only has live performing acts mostly. So to be able to handle it, we need to have a band on stage. So that was an important factor.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you next. So you kind of have already alluded to that, because you sign, from what it sounds like, Tom, as a solo act, but those albums on Roadrunner are kind of like the Junkie XL band. You have Patrick, you have...
Yeah, the first two or three albums, I think, were the band.
So that was a conscious decision to try to make it a more marketable thing to a rock audience?
Yeah, I think Alain was very, as a marketing guy, he was, of course, like, hey, how can we put this in the market? And I agreed, it needs to have a band that can be playing live. And then we started to think together with Tom, okay, what can we do? One of the names that popped up was Rude Boy. And I don't know how it came up. I think through discussions that we had, wouldn't it be great to have someone like Rude Boy on board? And we were like, that's probably impossible. He will never do it. And then I said, well, let me just send a tape, send a cassette tape with the tracks to Virgin Records. And at that time, it was Dutch A&R. And Virgin Records still had the Urban Dance Squad. And they released their album. And the A&R there said to me, well, if I get a cassette, I will send it to Rude Boy and we'll see what he says. He was... the A&R at Virgin was enthusiastic about the idea. And then Rude Boy got the cassette. And like one day later, or 2 days later, I got a call from the Virgin A&R, was Flip van der Ende, that Rude Boy was interested, heavily interested. So that was, of course, like, whoa, great. That's dream coming true. And that's when it all started, because then I think Rude Boy and Tom were, getting together more and finished the songs. And that's how we built a band around it.
We'll be back after a quick break.
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at RootsMusicRambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
Was there ever any conflict between Virgin and Roadrunner as far as, Rude Boy being on both labels essentially at one point?
What I remember is that the lawyer of Roadrunner and with Virgin Records, it all went very smooth. And there wasn't any problem with that. I mean, Rude Boy really wants to do it. So, you know, you can't really stop someone if someone is super enthusiastic. And, So that was all went quite smooth. Maybe also because it was in the Netherlands, that relatively small country. And the music industry is small in general. And then in the Netherlands, it's very small. So, you know, just one call away to make a deal.
So did you bring Patrick in after the instrumentals had already been kind of developed with Tom?
I think Tom first made a few tracks, you know, before the whole finishing of the album. He made like a demo, you know, for Junkie XL. So because I think we also needed to convince Case Vessels, the big boss of Roadrunner, to put money in the project and to sign it. In the end, we signed it for both records and publishing. Funny enough, at that time, I didn't have a clue about music publishing. We just signed it anyway. You know, I got the agreement to say, oh, yeah, let me give it to Tom. And Tom, I think he signed it without really checking what was in it. He was so happy that something could get released. It wasn't really normal to have a lawyer to look at deals in the Netherlands. Was mostly like you would look at your own, you would look at the contract yourself or have a manager look at it, but not a lawyer, because that was too expensive. That was in general. So I guess that was the same for Tom at that time.
So, you know, it's got some guest musicians on here. Most notably, I would think Dino from Fear Factory does the guitar on the album. So are you a part of that? Well, I know they already know each other because of the Fear Factory remixes, but is that another thing that you're pitching with him? Are you guys kind of, I guess what I'm saying is, are you kind of meeting together to try to come up with ideas for how you're going to put this?
Musically, it was more Tom who was doing mostly. And of course, we checked in once in a while to check what we liked or not, and, you know, for the direction. But putting the band together, I was quite involved in that. I eventually came up with Frankie D, who was a scratcher guy. In the first instance, it was great because he was very energetic and stuff, and a cool character. In the end, it didn't really work out. But later on, we realized that it didn't work out. But So I was more involved in putting the band together with Tom, or at least think about it and you know, get in touch with people. And on the music level, it was more like a helicopter view, you know, because Tom was so talented. He still is, of course, a multi-instrumentalist. And I think the only worry was that it would sound too much like Prodigy. That was my worry with some tracks. So I think also together with Alain Verhaven, you know, we said, hey, maybe change it a little because it's going to be too much otherwise.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it has a strong Prodigy influence for sure, but I think it has a lot more of those pop sensibilities that you kind of mentioned in a lot of songs like Saturday Teenage Kick or something like that, where it differentiates itself. But certainly the comparisons would have to be there because they have similar ideals.
Yeah. Big Beat is I think the best name to put on it. I remember that Tom had his CD from Fatboy Slim in his studio, which he was listening to, which at that time was, of course, the number one big beat DJ producer in the world. So,
and is the success of things like Fatboy Slim what kind of causes Roadrunner to want to push this album to not just in the Netherlands but also in like the US and other markets?
Because with Junkie XL and having a band that could perform live, most Roadrunner offices were like, hey, this sounds very international. We can do something with this. If the band can perform live, then we can, you know, put promo around it. So the fact that we had the band together and music videos from the first moment, I think that made the big difference to become an international release.
I know that you work with another band on Roadrunner called Kong, and they don't get a US release, but Junkie XL is involved in that too.
No, Kong was more, They also had an interesting live appearance because they played in a quadraphonic way. So if you go to a live show of Kong, then you're in the middle of the venue and they play around you. You know, on four corners of the venue, the band members play, and then the music comes to you in out of four corners, if you know what I mean.
Oh, so, wow. Is that a common thing?
That was there. I think that still exists, but that was their kind of, how to say, unique selling point. but they were, I think it was music wise, it wasn't commercial enough to really internationally do something. And with Junkie XL, there were some really catchy tunes on it. And the fact that Root Boy was on there, we all knew from the start that would help a lot, because he's an artist, you know, he's a real artist. He has this charisma and energy. And
was there a point when you got that finished product of Saturday Teenage Kick where you thought like there were some songs on there that you could really push to maybe be a big hit, especially when you're seeing kind of similar artists around the world starting to get big hits like that?
Well, we knew that Billy Club and Saturday Teenage Kick were two very catchy tunes on the album. And there were some other tracks there on there that were also catchy, maybe not radio friendly enough. But, you know, at that time, it was electronic music was a different kind of, how to say, scene, especially the more big beat scene. It was more a festival thing. You could have a big festival hit with an electronic track, a hip hop big beat track. So for us, the level of success was also looking at the live performances increasing. If a band has a lot of live performances, it can also be hugely successful. Although they might not be on the radio or very little on the radio. So that's how we also looked at Junkie XL.
Were you also involved in the second album for Roadrunner with Junkie XL?
Yeah, the first and the second album, I was with Roadrunner. That's after that I left Roadrunner. So I was involved with the first two albums. Yeah.
Is there anything you learned from doing Saturday Teenage Kick that you adjusted to when you guys did the second record?
You know, it was so extremely from one moment to the other, so extremely busy that I had a day job on the A&R side, because Junkie XL was so successful from the start and popular that there was a lot of things to do, and we all knew that we needed to have a follow-up quite, I would say, quickly or not too long. It was a little bit of a struggle maybe to again get like radio crossover tracks. I would maybe have, you know, suggested to get some songwriters in, additional songwriters from, you know, to help Tom and you know, create that really original 2 to 3 tracks on the album that can be singles.
Sure, a whirlwind of things happening. Everything's happening so fast. Well, I was just thinking, you know, you're product manager one day, the next day you're signing this unique act and it's blowing up and you got the guy from Urban Dance Squad involved. I mean, it must have felt like just so much was happening at one time.
And I was quite young. I think I was 24 at the time. And Tom was like 8 years older, 7 years older. There was also, I now realize, if I look at my career now, that if you're an A&R, it's always helpful to have a certain track record and that you're at least like 10 years older than the band or the artist or the songwriter. and why is that? Because if you have an idea as an A&R and you want to put something forward, they have to accept it, yeah, the artist or the songwriter, or at least think about it. I was younger. I didn't have any experience. So it was very difficult for me to really, of course, be putting pressure to Tom, or it was almost impossible. So I was more learning on the road with the A&R.
So were there ideas like bringing in other songwriters and things like that you suggested that kind of got shut down because you feel like maybe he saw himself as the elder statesman versus you?
At that time, we never really discussed it, I think. What we tried is to have, for example, for like a radio song, a special remix, or get someone in to make a different version, which was always quite difficult because Tom was really good. So why get someone in while Tom was already on a high level?
Did you sign any other bands to Roadrunner besides Junkie XL and Kong?
Well, we I had a Dutch language project. That was just like more pop music. Because I didn't want to focus only on alternative stuff. And there was I had contacts with Josh Homme from the Queens of the Stone Age, because he was in Amsterdam quite often. And I started also at the same time make compilations. So I made an electronic compilation with dance stuff, which I licensed mostly from Played Against Him, which were kind of friends of us. And I made a compilation called Burn One Up, which was a stoner rock compilation. And I did that together with Montikoner. And it was great because, for me, Montikoner was a god, you know. So I was like, oh, I can work with Montikoner. That's great and awesome. And then, we called about it and, had a calls about which bands to suggest and on the email, of course. And then I had I was able to, because Josh Homme was in Amsterdam quite often, I was able to meet him through friends of us, an Amsterdam band called Beaver, which was also stoner rock. So they were friends with Josh, and I was friends with some people from Beaver. And I was like, hey, wouldn't it be great to have a track from Josh Homme on the Burn One Up compilation? And he was... Caius was, already stopped for a year or more. And I think he was slowly already thinking about a new project. And that's where we had one track that he recorded together with a few of the Beaver band members in Amsterdam. And it was actually as a Queens of the Stone Age track, as the first track on that Burn One Up compilation. And it also led to the fact that Queens of the Stone Age eventually got a European licensing deal with Roadrunner for the first album. So I kind of, got Monty to get in touch with Josh through me. And then Monty picked it up and got in touch with Josh and his management to figure out a European deal for the album.
Were you the project manager the product manager for Saturday Teenage Kick also, in addition to being A&R?
We'll be back after a quick break.
But you still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man.
I'm
trying.
Already?
Oh, yeah, I'm trying to get them on there. Yeah. We all artists, man. We gonna have this like,
bro, me and my man Kyle, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now. I gotta lie, we play with this shit right now for real.
Don't play with it, take that shit serious.
I think it was the A&R job was kind of also including product work. Yeah. So it was A&R manager in a very wide way or a wide range. So it included a lot of tasks that maybe could also be a product manager task. But I think you could say yes for all the Junkie Excel stuff. I don't think there was a product manager at that time. At Roadrunner involved with Junkie XL was just me as an A&R, and what needed to be done was, of course, getting the marketing in place, which was Alan's job, and make sure that everybody had their materials, and especially with the USA release, there was quite some things going on because they wanted to have a different artwork of the first album, and we had a lot of discussions with that together with Tom Holkeborg, because we all thought that the album artwork was good as it was. It featured Root Boy on in front of it with his hat, and but then the Americans wanted to have a more abstract kind of design. Maybe they were afraid that it was looking too much hip hop or something. And well, in the end, we said, okay, let's do it. But there was a lot of discussions about that. And there was a lot of discussions about the fact that they wanted a lot of promotion, they wanted Root Boy to be available for a promotion. But Root Boy wasn't really eager to fly to the USA to do promo stuff. So that was also a point of discussion. I remember that I had a meeting with one of the, I think a product manager at Roadrunner New York office. And he was like, okay, you know, you need to convince Root Boy that he has to do promotion because, you know, we need him on board on the Junkie XL record to be available for interviews and everything.
Yeah, and I don't see Root Boy doing anything he doesn't want to do.
That's right.
So the version that I have actually, so it's just like this kind of solid blue cover, but I know I've seen one that looks like segmented.
Well, that's the USA. I think that's the USA version.
Okay.
But there's one that looks a little bit the same, but it has Root Boy, his face on the front with some, you know, stripes as if it's like a television that is distorted.
You mentioned before that you're a metal guy. So were there bands on Roadrunner that you were already a big fan of when you came into working for them?
Type O Negative was one of the, you know, the bands that I was the biggest fan of, I think. I'm more, you know, I played bass in a doom metal band called Dutch band called Celestial Season. And we reunited actually now. So we are kind of making, we made a new album a year ago and we're making starting to write again for our next album. But I liked a lot of the metal stuff. I mean, of course, Fear Factory, Sepultura.
Celestial Season sounds like you guys wear the makeup and they're going to burn a church or something. That sounds very
heavy. No. Actually, it's, you know, the tea brand called Celestial Seasonings is a tea brand.
Oh, is that
and
true?
I think we got the name from that. So we thought that the logo of Celestial Seasonings tea was a great logo. So we just cut off the last part and used that logo initially. Later on, we changed it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned at the very beginning that, you know, there were kind of two different scenes for the dance music. There was like kind of the cheesier pop top 40 stuff. And there was the alternative. And then Junkie XL happens, but Tom gets his big break doing a cheesy top 40 remix of Elvis.
Yeah. That's true. And that's actually that opened a lot of doors for him, especially of course, into the ad commercials, ad campaigns, commercials, television world. Because he actually made that one, I think, for a commercial, and it ended up as a single and then became a big hit. It was for Nike, Nike ad, I can remember. And at that time, also, the dance became more popular, the more normal dance, I'd say the electro, techno, straightforward dance. I wasn't involved anymore, but that's, I think, where Tom was like, hey, maybe I should jump on that train, because that's getting so big, you know, the EDM.
So you're involved with the first two records. After that, you leave Roadrunner in what, like 99, 2000?
So yeah, 2000.
What led to that departure and what did you do afterwards besides rip off tea labels?
I was, of course, still quite young. A&R, I was a little bit struggling in the A&R side, which is funny because now if I look back, I know exactly what I did wrong or what I should have done. But anyway, And Case Wrestles hired a guy who was like a pop commercial A&R person. An older guy, his name was Charlie Prick. What's in the name? And I couldn't get along with that guy. And he was just not my type of character. And I'm a person. I mean, now I would have just, you know, I probably wouldn't care about it. But at that time, I was just like, okay, this is not the person I can work with. And he was supposed to lead like a European A&R, having to supervise me in a way. And that just didn't work out. You know, he wanted me to sign a very commercial pop projects, which at that time I wasn't really into. And the his character and my character were just not fitting, you know. And so I was fed up with it, and I decided just to leave Roadrunner. In the end, I started to work for a music publishing company, Warner Chappell. So after Roadrunner, I went into music publishing. That's where I'm still in or worked in the last, you know, 20 years in music publishing.
So when you think of this time in your life, I know you're very young at the time, signing Junkie XL, what is it that first stands out to you as far as this moment in your life, you know, this part of your music industry journey? You know, is this a pivotal point, or is it just kind of
it was super exciting. It was like it was really awesome because things happened so fast and so quick and became so popular instantly, that and I was so busy and there was it was like a dream coming true. You know, I wanted to become an A&R manager. And then I, all of a sudden I was in New York and we were at the Junkie XL showcase at the Meatpacking District. And that, you know, that was all happening in half a year time or something. It was actually when I was, I remember that, I think it was like early 2000 or 1999 in the last, in the fall or something. And I was at Tom's studio and he was like, Lucas, Lucas, we have a problem, you know. You have to really do something about the BitTorrent stuff, that illegal downloading stuff. And I was like, and internet was just kind of happening. And I, you know, we had email, but Case Wessel still had a fax, two fax machines on his office. And email was doing okay. And we had, you know, the phones with SMS, but that was about it. And I was, internet was really more for the nerds, the geeks still. It wasn't really that developed yet. Facebook wasn't there yet. You know, there was Facebook became in 2004, I think. And Tom was like, yeah, this is a huge problem. You know, they're gonna be able to just get the album and don't pay for it. And I was like, what's all the fuss about? You know, don't worry. And and I was like, internet, who worries about the internet, you know? but eventually I think Tom even had a meeting with Case Wessels about it, but it was all, you know, in the very early stages of BitTorrent. But I think he got right in what happened. You know, in the end, it was of course a big problem, and a lot of record labels had to didn't survive and had to cut down in their staff. And but that's one of the most important moments that I had with Tom, where he was really warning us for the BitTorrent situation and the illegal downloading, or let's say the downloading situation, which was at that moment just starting. But what I said, I was young, you know, inexperienced. So it would have been great if at that time there would be like some sort of mentor, or although Monty Connor helped me out with some stuff, of course. But I learned a lot of things. And of course, we all made little mistakes here and there. But it was a great time for everybody.
Thanks so much to Lucas for going back in time with us. And you can actually check out his band Celestial Season on both any streaming service that you may use, or also burningworldrecords.com has their whole discography available for some cool vinyl editions, and a new album coming soon. So check that out. But now that we know how Lucas came to Roadrunner Records and how he helped bring Tom Hulkenberg, Junkie XL, to Roadrunner Records, we're going to find out about some other key players that took part in this album. Dino Cazares of Fear Factory, he plays guitar on it, but the most important by far is the addition of the Silver Surfer and Rude Boy Remington, Patrick Thielen of Urban Dance Squad. Now, Urban Dance Squad is definitely like your favorite band kind of crew. I remember when I was younger, I used to have this magazine that I still have, so also when I'm older, that had a band give up their Desert Island discs, you know, like an album that you would take to a desert island with you. It's the only album you can listen to. And most people would be like, oh, you know, I want to take the Beatles, or I'm going to take Jimi Hendrix or Bob Marley. But I didn't really care about that kind of stuff. But one person in particular said they would take Urban Dance Squad's Mental Floss for the Globe. And I was like, I don't know what that is, but I want to find out. And that's when I heard this song. And from then on, I was all about it, and I was constantly see bands giving respect to Urban Band Squad. 311, Two Skinny J's, The Urge, you know, all these bands that I loved were constantly saying how much they loved Urban Band Squad. So I said that to say that it's a real treat to get to talk to Patrick, because he's a true living legend in my world and in my mind, and I know a lot of other people, so it's really cool to talk to him, not only in general, but also about this specific project, where it's outside of the thing I know him from. It's Junkie XL, this kind of second chapter, maybe more than second chapter, but another chapter in his career. So he was very gracious with his time and very forthcoming with his stories, so we're going to get into it right now. Junkie XL kind of goes from being Tom to like kind of a band, you know, with you and others involved. So I was curious how you even got, you know, involved with Tom doing that.
But it's a funny story. It's like I was at home because I was in the urban dance squad constantly touring. Then when I came home, there was this letter, a big one. And it basically came from one of these people from Virgin. And Virgin, I just got signed on Virgin, first Holland, then the United States and so on. I opened the letter and there was this, a letter and another letter. The first letter was an explanation by one of these people that used to work for the Urban Dance Squad, actually a bad one, but that's another story. He said, listen, this guy wants to make a record with a song with you, so-and-so. He sent you some material. See what you can do. The other letter was basically Tom Holkeborg asking me if it was possible to make at least one song. I heard all those. He had about, like, sent me about 8 musical things. And all 8, I just wrote down all 8. I just felt it was so good to my point of view. He didn't know what I would do, nor the title. So I came with the title. So, and I gave him 8. And then I called him. And he said, yeah, man, wow, okay, you come to my house. And he used to live in Amsterdam West, the part where, you know, that's, these are old buildings. And he lived in one apartment with no second floor. It was just one floor. His living room was actually also the studio, something like that. He used certain cabinets as echo chambers or whatever. He did everything in that house and nobody knew about it because nobody gave a damn. So he thought, like, a lot of people also told him, like, are you sure you want to ask Root Boy? Because he's known to be pretty stubborn, strange, hard to work with, which is bullshit. But he said, that's what you're saying. I just want to see the man and hear the man to judge. So he did, and he realized this guy is not difficult at all. So I came to his house. We ate some certain dish, which is called roti, which is basically the pancake with your hands and a lot of curry stuff and even a lot of spicy peppers. We ate in his house. We talked. We left. I saw how he lived. His bed, I couldn't even see his bed. I don't know how he slept. I think with a mattress put away somewhere, and that was it. And I told him I date all 8 of them, and he was so happy. And he didn't have no structure of, like, having an he didn't have a manager. He didn't have a tour manager. He had nothing. So after a while, I told him, listen, let me just ask the certain people in the Urban Dance Squad who work for the Urban Dance Squad and actually friends of the Urban Dance Squad, if they are open to do you, because they don't know what they were talking, what we were talking about. Then I the front of house for a guy, Hugo Scholten, and he used to do later on for Rammstein, but he was for the Urban Dance Squad. Then suddenly jumping in with Junkie XL. I get the tour manager for Urban Dance Squad called Flip Van Omener back then, doing Junkie XL. The drummer of the Urban Dance Squad didn't like that much, but I said, no, listen, you shouldn't talk like this because these people are honest, and let's just work with this because the Urban Dance Squad can defy this shit anyway. So that's how it started. I made these 8 or 7 songs. There was another one called Melange. I called it like that. He didn't know what to do with that song, so I said, oh, I know exactly what to do. So I just wrote the thing and did the vocals and was caught ready. And the rest you know. Then later on, the United States of America, like Roadrunner USA, got involved. And I was told that the moment they heard I was in, then they were kind of convinced immediately, double. So, and that was something that I really respected and admired and was thankful, grateful of. And that was it, you know, and that's how we started. He also already told me his idea of the band that he wanted a guitar player called René van der Zee. He used to be in a punk rock band called Cooper. He used to get a drummer called Basmati. He was doing some fusion stuff all the time. He was good. So he got him. And we got Frankie D as a DJ. And he used to be also a club dancer, so that would came in handy. And then we got the band. And basically, the thing with Tom Alkaborg is that he had bad experiences with bands. He came from a band called Weekend at Waikiki. And this band was based in Groningen, up in Friesland there. That he was used as a doormat almost, because he was very young, but very good in engineering. So this band always got him and told him, like, do this, do that. And they walked away, and he was doing the whole process. He was very young, so that was a bad experience for him. Then he figured, like, that's not never going to happen again. So he was in combination with another dude. That band was called Nerf, and it was more something for Roadrunner in general, like loud music and heavy, like almost like industrial stuff. And you would think that they wouldn't really clash because there were only two members in that group. But that happened because after a while, the British guy, who was actually a cool dude, kind of made a lot of difficulties. And Tom was, again, disappointed with people cooperating with people. Then he figured, okay, from now on, I'm going to take everything into my own hands. But the lyricist, it got to be somebody. So that's how he asked me. But he already had in mind for the band. But he felt still, even if it was a band, that he would have the supervision of it all, except for the lyrics and the vocals. Because that had to do with these two experiences that really hurt him. And he figured, like, if I can see everything, oversee everything, that won't happen again. My point of view is, I think that was a wrong move, because the first Junkie XL band was really cool. And there was a discussion somewhere in Montpellier in France while we were just on tour with his first album, Saturday Teenage Kick. The guitar player wanted to make some songs and therefore get maybe some credits lyrically, like the copyrights of these songs. And he didn't want that. And also with the drummer, he had this discussion. So eventually, I think because of that, they kind of lost these people, because they were dedicated to Junkie XL. And even Rene van der Zee, the guitar player from Cooper, he had a wife already, I think a child, I'm not sure. And he used to try to get into a band called Helmet, and they nearly took him. So he felt like, why, you know? Why this superstition stuff, you know? Why the distrust? But I could understand why Tom was doing it, because he experienced so many bullshit things. So he figured, I'm going to be in charge of everything, because if I don't, that might happen again. Because with the second album, we wanted the new band, but the deals he had made with Roadrunner Holland was so hard to work with that he didn't have no money. He had to take the band off the road, because his tax experts, they told, actually the same one as I had, said, keep that band off the road because you're $150,000 in debt. Because basically his deal. That's the reason why he tried to first figure out the second Junkie XL. He already had to keep players, but they didn't go in. I don't know why. That's something to do with money or something. And therefore, he chose to be on his own and with me, and later on his own. And I could understand that, because in the end, you know what Tom Alkaborg is doing now. I mean, he made this a new life. It's a different musician, but he made it, and you know, he made build his own castle. And now he's okay. He's doing what he does, you know, what he's doing. He loves it. And I think he still wants to be in a band.
Well, I mean, you kind of laid out, you know, how you guys collaborated. So are these songs essentially done besides your vocals when you go to his house in these humble livings?
Well, the thing is, he obviously sends beats and tracks like that. He doesn't know what's going will go on, because eventually that's my task, because I have to either read and especially listen to the sound, which means that I do not do what I like. I'll do what is needed. That's a very big misconception about me. People, like most people, they do what they want to do. Like, oh, I'm this, I'm going to do that. That's not me. I'm just listening. I claim that the sounds talk to me. That's what I claim. And therefore, I have the title. If I have the title, I have the record, because, or the song. That's how it works for me. I don't, other people work in a different way. I just, that's the way I work. So when I came, I have these lyrics. I had everything set in the particular way, whether it was a verse, chorus, verse, and so on, and outros and stuff like that. And it depended on what type of song it actually was or what I heard. Like Metrolike is a different way of seeing things compared to Saturday Teenage Kick or Melange or whatever. So I went to him. He immediately, we were recorded it. He was happy. For the album, on a summer's day, it was fucking hot. We went to a guy who was in a band called Plexus, but he had only like the opportunity to record up in a room where the microphone was hanging on the ceiling and where I had to put step on a stool and just basically bend front to do the vocal. Plus, the window of that particular room was open because it's so freaking hot. And I was doing underachievers and shit like that. And loud, like screaming at you.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Underachievers in particular, it sounds like you're screaming, like way yeah. more aggressive than, you know, any Urban Dance Squad song is. You're like yelling. Yeah.
And these people out, they had their, like, families and their children were, like, enjoying the sun. And he's hearing this bullshit upstairs from a guy who is just screaming his ass off. Can you imagine? And I did that. These were keepers. That was basically the vocal for the whole album. Listen, how we work was like, I come with the vocals. He heard the vocals, like, damn. The next day, he's like, because of your vocals, I did this. I changed this. I changed that. I said, yo, man, no problem. That's good. And that's how he anticipates on what is done. Do you understand? It's not like this is like laid in some mold, in a mold, and therefore nothing can change. No, he hears what you're doing, and then like, damn, I know where you're going to. And then he's adapting on that and changing things. And therefore, I tell him a little explanation, like, this is what I'm going to do on this song. This is what I'm thinking about, so and so, and let's work. And then we work step by step. Then when he got the vocal recording, he's like, yo, oh, man. And then I leave him and I go home. Then he's working on that shit maybe the whole night. So the next day I come, he's like, check this. I'm like, yeah, incredible. That's how he works.
You know, because like in Billy Club, you say the line dealing with the roster, and then there's dealing with the roster. So is that kind of, he just hears that line. He's like, that's a sick line. I'm going to make a whole song
that,
around
that
it.
That line he took. Dealing with the roster, Two-Face. Then I didn't know about it. Then the next day I came, he said, check this, man. And I heard it. I'm like, God, fuck. I'm like, this no joke. That's good. And he said, I took it from Billy. I said, whatever, man. No problem. So that's how he works. If he feels like there's an opportunity there to create something totally different with one snippet of something that's already exists, he's going to do it. And it could be very simple. The simplicity is not the problem. The problem is your idea good? And can you really work that idea out? And it's always been like that. With the Beatles, my favorite band, it's the same thing. Their ideas are exceptionally good. Therefore, if you dig in that idea and you kind of crystallize it out, it will be no joke. But if your idea ain't good, people talk about songs like good and bad songs. Well, you also got good and bad melodies, you know? So the thing with me is I believe that whatever idea you have, it better be a good idea. It might be for an outsider something that's very easy or cheap, but it to work out a good idea that gives you a good song, you know? And I think that most of the times you should basically work on that basis. It's very hard to explain it, but it's easy to understand when you do these things. It's like, it's around you. For a lyricist, and even like somebody like him, I think he might give it a different explanation, but it's basically the same. It's like, it's around you, really. It's all, music is basically all around you.
Did he give you the title Saturday Teenage Kick, or is that something you
came up with? No, that was me. That was me, because I didn't know he wanted to. No, he told me later on he wanted to name the album like that. But I had Saturday Teenage Kid wrote that down. And the reason was that I always was a fan of a song by a band that I always checked live back in the days called The Undertones. And The Undertones had a song like Teenage Kicks. And I always loved that song because I knew what they were talking about. Then I figured it's going to be Saturday Teenage Kicks, because on a Saturday, I always loved the Saturdays. Therefore, I figured I'm going to use also that element by The Undertones, because, yeah, it makes sense. On a Saturday, everybody goes berserk, especially when you're younger. You think about sex, drink, shit like that. So that's the reason why I used that term. And I told him it's called Saturday Teenage Kicks. He said, you got that from The Undertones? I said, yeah, but it's not The Undertones. This one is about a particular, it's basically a particular day, the Saturday. You have Friday, which is no joke. You have Saturday. So I used the Saturday with the Teenage Kicks. You get Saturday Teenage Kicks with an idea that I have to work out. So I did.
Yeah, that song is a hit. That's a banger.
Yeah, but it came from the fact I love the Undertones so much. That was a hell of a band too, you know, and I saw them live several times as a youngster, and I figured, no joke. And I never knew I would use that term, but because of the music, it just, like I told you, I'm listening to the music. I heard the sounds and how he built that strange thing up. It's got to be something about debauchery and shit like that. And I knew this is the title because that's what it's telling me to do so. So I did. I'm telling you, everything you're going to do, you just has to just go into it, just focus, and let it basically fill you. And you will get the answer, because if you listen close to sounds, for most people, sounds, whether they're musicians or not, most sounds are like sounds. Not to me. I believe you have to write in a particular way. You have to, especially have to say certain things because of that sound. You know, I know like Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles, the history behind that song, but he said that, his idea, first of all, he was looking for a particular name that should must ring a bell, and that was Eleanor Rigby. That was not an average title. That was like hearing something and saying, this is a title. And the way they use the music is so impressive with the words. And words are music when you put it with the music. It is music. So it's, in my point of view, he's listening to his own ideas and the sounds, going back to George Martin, explained to him certain classical elements. And Martin was an expert and a maverick in, first of all, instrumentation. Second, to immediately pinpoint for what type of idea an instrument should be used.
When you said Saturday Teenage Kick to Tom, he goes, oh, The Undertones. So did you guys have similar music tastes that he immediately?
In general, yeah. This is funny. This is a nice question. The thing with, I was always a Beatlehead. So all the 60s, I'm really into that. Tom knows some, but the Beatles, he wasn't into. He kind of passed it by. He explained it to me. But the second album, he was buying the whole Beatle collection and hearing it, and then figured, okay, I know enough. Because he knew that I always was a Beatle head. Therefore, he felt like, let's do this with more 60s influence. I said, of course. But I was the Beatle. I'm always the Beatle head. The fun, like, he's more into Pink Floyd. A lot of industrial things. I was more into either strange metal or especially punk rock, and especially the British wave. That's me. So it is funny how two guys come together, walk on the same soil, but at the same time, walking on the same soil, you figure out he's got some different soil in his pockets. And I have different soil in my pockets. My dad was in the best band to Suriname. And we even played 60s music and ska music, and was the best band from the country. And I saw my father playing, performing when I was 3 years old. With me, the Beatles, everything from the Yardbirds, Dave Clark Five, the Kings, especially, The Who, I knew these things because my dad was playing them.
I was always more drawn to Yardbirds than the Beatles because they were kind of like a little bit heavier. I know it's still like not heavy, quote unquote, but to
no,
me
it's
they...
still heavy. No, you said it the right. No, you said it right. The misconception is that people think it's not heavy.
Okay.
The shit is like this. It's so heavy, but they make it so sugary for you that you're going to swallow. And then while you're trying, oh, I'm pretty sweet, yeah. But the fact is, it's so hardcore, you have no idea. Three Beatle periods, the first period, the second period, and the last period. So even in the first period, I can understand when people said, well, they sound pretty, you know, easy. I'm like, that's what you think, but you should have seen them perform live. They fucking kill you. If you look footage by the Beatles from on every YouTube or whatever, and you hear them sore standing there, and you hear the beat, what the fuck? That's hardcore, you know. And people underestimate that, especially when it comes to Ringo Starr, because Ringo Starr is one of the best drummers ever. You kidding me? People think, oh, they took him just for the fun of it. Are you crazy? They knew exactly why they used Richard Stark. He kept the band together, especially live.
Well, you know where Ringo messed up was taking that Skechers endorsement. That's where I started. I was like, come on, Ringo. What are you doing wearing Skechers? That's where he lost it for me. But other than that, nothing but respect. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Whatever. You know, I mean, if it makes his boat float... I wouldn't do that, but then again, the guy's filthy rich.
That's what I'm saying. He could have held out for like Adidas or something. He could have made a real deal. That's why I'm disappointed in him is what it is.
I guess he had no taste in casual shoes. You know, he has no taste for that. And I will forgive him because it's Richard Starkey, you know?
He's the only one though. I'm not giving anybody else any Skechers passes.
I hear you, man. I mean, it's pretty... a pretty fucked up brand, actually, you know, so, but I'm not walking on sketches.
Thank you. I wanted to be clear because I didn't want to.
I don't dwell on that one. Okay. No, absolutely not.
Metro-like, you kind of touched on earlier. It sounded like to me like you were maybe just kind of freestyling for like several minutes and maybe he chopped up what you had, or is that, did you have it exactly?
No, I kind of wrote this one easy to give you an idea of information around you in the city, something like that. I knew that song needed that. I didn't want to go that, like I'm writing you a pamphlet. It was more, what is the city? You know, what is the inner city? What am I feeling? I call that metro life. Like being in a metro, everything around you, people around you, sometimes a little bit of space, sometimes no space. It was easy writing. The atmosphere, I figured, I'm going to do this. Again, I felt that the song said that I had to do it like that because it's also kind of monotonous type of vibe, you know, it goes on.
Yeah.
And I thought that the soundscapes by Tom were at that point more important than what I would fill in and try to hijack the whole song. That wasn't my intention. I just followed the atmosphere of the sounds. And I figured I have to be second level instead of first level. That's the difference between great singing and singing the song. Singing the song is better because it gives more, how do you call, more information, oh, especially emotionally.
To that same point, I think that having a good song is better than being able to sing it well.
Exactly. It would rap the same thing, but you have to follow what is there. Not like, I am this guy, I think I'm the greatest singer, so I'm going to do something. That won't impress me. A lot of people actually confuse even as artists. They think that they are very, very, very special. And they need to be treated in that way. And they also need to be approached like that. I don't believe in that shit. Don't think that you're so special that everything is okay when you demand people to bow down for you. If I have to go in particular circuits to make it big and to be seen in the right places with the right people, then I'm out of here. I'm just, it won't work.
He said Tom was kind of more into industrial stuff. And of course, Dino Cazares from Fear Factory plays guitar on the album. Were you present for that recording?
I wasn't present with that because he worked periods. Like, if he had a particular idea with a particular song, he would get him for guitars. And they loved him, you know? So all these guys, he was close with them. And they loved to be part of whatever that would be. He told me about it. And I said, yeah, it sounds great. So it was already there in his bank. You know, what he does with you, if you are a guitar player, this is pretty interesting. He lets you play whatever. He might give you hints, but in Dino's case, I think he used the whole thing, but sometimes he's chopping it up.
He'll be given a whole riff and he'll take pieces of what he wants to use and place it where he wants to put it.
But it depends, because sometimes he's asking you to play all out one solo part for a reason, for maybe a middle eight or whatever. I know that he loves the fact, and again, we come back on that, what happened with him back in the days. He needs to feel free to do and use whatever he wants. That's a freedom he really cherishes. And he still gives you the credit, don't get me wrong. It's just he wants to have the ability and the freedom to use elements the way he sees it. Otherwise, he's not really happy.
With the way that Urban Dance Squad was kind of going towards a more like hard rock approach versus maybe like Mental Floss, you know, things like Persona Non Grata are a little bit more guitar driven. Was that something that attracted you to the Junkie XL songs, or you were just into the vibe?
The thing is, I know all these elements even before I was in a band. That's the secret behind me. If you see, like, I never make a big fuss out of color. My dad was a colored person. I'm a colored person. I know where I'm from. My mother is an American black woman and living there. And my sister, Catherine, is living there too and was born in Boston, Massachusetts. The thing is this. From an early age, I learned not to think in segments like that. It's either great or not. I was born and raised with so many guitar sounds that you would probably expect me to go out as a full lead guitar player. I don't, because my attraction to the instigator is bigger. The guitar player to me, and I'm thinking in military terms, is more a flyboy, like a pilot. The pilots in the Great War were above everything. And when they come down, they have the stories. That's a guitar player to me. A drummer is heavy artillery. A bass player is mobile artillery. The vocalist, that's grunt. That's paratrooper infantry. Okay, so that's how I see things. And I was raised so many records just by guitar parts and playing that I figured they are my friends. So as a vocalist, I was always the type of guy that would tell the guitar player, play as loud as you can, because somehow I will get there. other band, other singers, they will tell the opposite. They will tell you, I need to hear myself. Can you crank up my monitor loud because I need to hear what I'm singing? That sort of, that's not me. Because I believe that I will get there in between the whole tornado. Mm-hmm. The drums are loud as fuck, always. It's an acoustic instrument, and you kind of amplify the whole crap. It's loud as fuck, you know? Guitar players, they crank that shit up, you know? And they want to be the loudest. So as a vocalist in the urban dance world, they played extremely loud. You cannot be squeamish. So for me to hear Junkie XL using guitars, it was the way he used it. Like, the beats with guitars were, that was the thing to me. And the guitar elements, how he used it, the way, the taste, how to use it, that I liked about him. Urban Dance Squad, we got a hell of a guitar player who will probably do 3 or 4 tracks, guitar tracks on one song. Live, he will pick anyone, what he considered the main, and just kind of mix it up with elements of the second or the third track, guitar track from the recording, and do it live. Tom's way of using that shit was different. Was also the metal thing and all these type of influences, he used it in a different way, especially with the beats. That was so, how should I say, kick ass, you know? And he loved that. He already told people back in the day before my time, I'm going to make a record now with guitars and beats. And everybody was like, whatever. But he did it. And that's one of the main reasons why a lot of people understood it, because these two were a great combination, loud guitars on beats back then. Because Tom used beats, literally beats, on with heavy metal guitars and stuff. That wasn't, not everybody did that.
And were you doing Urban Dance Squad simultaneously while performing live with Junkie XL?
Yes, and it was a big problem. Oh, okay. Because you have to understand. No, let me explain why. As you can see, it's not the artist, because the artist, moi, I thought it's easy to do so. The only thing you guys need to do, I told my management and stuff, is to fucking plan this right in an honest way so that no band falls into the cracks. I want every band to do what they need to do. So they said, but what's your priority? I said, I have 2 priorities. Junkie XL, Urban Dance Squad. They're like, yeah, but it's impossible. I said, just shut up. Both are possible. You need to plan right. And it goes like this. If Junkie XL has a record coming and is ready to go out, then you plan Junkie XL's first. Then every crack in that system, you plan the other band in. If the other band comes with a new release, then you know that there will be a tour, right? Then it's the other way around. Then that band gets the first imprinting of the whole schedule, and the others, they follow. And that's how I told them to work. I said, it's easy. And now here it comes. The company people, I was signed on Virgin with Urban Dance Squad, and I was basically rolling with Tom Holkeborg, who was signed by Roadrunner. But Roadrunner didn't like the fact that I was also in the squad, because they figured he's with Junkie XL, and that needs to have priority. The other companies said the same thing, but in their own terms. You're like, we want actually Root Boy to do Urban Dance Squad first, and maybe even stop Junkie XL. And I told them, go fuck yourself. I'm in Junkie XL and I'm in Urban Dance Squad. Get used to it. There is no difference. Even the press asked me, like, I thought they were very stupid, because it's really simple. If I can plan both bands, then I'm in both bands. And my heart lies with both of them. Otherwise, I wouldn't join Junkie XL. And otherwise, I wouldn't stay in the Urban Dance Club. So I said, go figure the shit out, because I'm not going to leave any band. And that was it.
Did you ever play shows with both bands at the same time, like the same show?
No. But if that would happen, I would do it.
I think that'd be sick. We should do it now.
You know? Music is a very strange thing. no matter what happens or happens, if you find common ground, always in music, it's going to happen.
Well, 60s guy, you mentioned you love that music. So when you first heard that Elvis remix, what did you think about that?
I thought it was, it's funny that you asked this because I thought it was finally, he got his freedom back. Even though they paid him one price for that remix. And the rest goes to the guy who literally wrote that song. That was an 80 years old dude who got a call from his son who told him, "Oh, dad, you got a number one hit all over the place." He's like, "Oh, really? Yeah. Okay." But the thing for Tom was, because of that, he got 10 times more lucrative deals. And that made his shit, because that Little F Conversation thing was just a door ram to go through the door, right? And get mega opportunities. And he did, you know? And that was his freedom. He was basically a prisoner before that. That's the real deal. And because of this Little ass guy, he busted himself out of that prison.
What is your favorite moment of making Saturday Teenage Kick?
I think Saturday Teenage Kick itself and the fact that me and Tom worked it out so fast. I mean, it was like child's play. It was like going on a holiday with your school class. You know, it's supposed to be like that. Because that is fun. If it's not fun, you should get the hell out. That's my whole opinion about music, is it's supposed to be child's play. It's supposed to be like we're small kids, and we were, and we always were. We talk about bullshit most of the time and laugh our asses off and drink soda pops and shit like that.
What's soda pop, though?
Oh, it could be like he loved back in the day, those Surinam soda pops called Fernandez. That's fucking extremely sweet and extremely chemical. But that shit we liked. Any type of drink, actually. He used to love a lot of hard liquor. That's why he got the name Junkie, because he never stopped. It was always excessive. Then he got a heart failure, just to let him know, the buddy know, this is the final straw and nothing else. So the doctor told him, don't live that lifestyle anymore. Be careful. He didn't sleep. That's why his name is Junkie, because they called him Junkie.
Switch to the soda pop.
Yeah, but I think he's not. The way he lives now could be very vegan, which is good. But it's something for him, actually. His mother used to be in these macrobiotic food. She was very strict and extremely religious, he told me. So he already knows that route. So it's possible that everything is like really pristine and really... I'm eating healthy food, actually, because I'm working out like 30 years almost. If you take yourself way too serious, even on that level, it won't do you no good, really. Humor and taking the shit light every now and then, that's needed, because the shit is already heavy enough. The world outside you doesn't give a fuck what you're doing, because they do their things. They don't care about that I'm doing a vocal and that Tom is hitting the mix table. They don't give a fuck. Even if the shit is hard, you better laugh somehow, because otherwise you won't make it.
The Rude Boy, come on. It doesn't get much better than that. Mad respect to Rude Boy for taking the time to talk about this album from 1997, but in 2022, Record Store Day specifically, The Cold Vein, his new project, will release their debut entitled Simple Trick More Voodoo, Record Store Day 2022, so keep a lookout for that. Keep a listen out for it, too. Don't just look at it. Listen to it. So that is Junkie XL's Saturday Teenage Kick, a legacy that began back then that continues to this day for all parties involved, and I couldn't be more excited to be able to talk about it with everybody. Thanks so much for checking out the show. If you like what you heard, tell a friend. If you didn't like what you heard, keep it to yourself.
And I will talk to you next week with an all-new episode involving another album in the Roadrunner Records catalog. But until then, my name is Ryan Rainbow, this is Meep Meep, and yes, that's the best I could come up with. Bye!
Beep, beep.